Director, Dr. Nipa Kamdar. Can I turn things over to you?
All right, thank you, Rob. So today we're going to talk about a presentation entitled We Are Trained to Survive, Using Human-Centered Design to Learn Veterans' Experiences Seeking Food Assistance. Next slide, please. All right, so there's my name, Nipa Kamdar, and I am a VA health science or health systems researcher at the Center for Innovations in Quality, Effectiveness, and Safety at Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center here in Houston, Texas. I am also an assistant professor at Baylor College of Medicine. And you'll notice by those credentials by my name that there are several dates listed there. Those dates matter because between 2000 and 2018, I worked primarily with individuals and in communities that lacked resources like food. But it wasn't really until about 2015 when I returned to school to get my PhD, that I really started to understand the impact that food insecurity and other basic needs had on health and people's well-being. Assessing for access to nutritious food and stable housing and other basic needs just wasn't really part of my routine assessment and largely not integrated into my treatment plans. So now that I'm doing research, it is my mission to build on those experiences that I had as a nurse in the field and produce work that will empower veterans at risk for food insecurity and their families to have more secure access to basic needs. Next slide, please. Before we get into today's presentation, I would like to introduce some members of my team. What you see, the first little picture with the three people in there, that's me and my boys. They are unofficial team members, as they often have to listen to me do presentations like this one. They also come with me on occasion to recruitment sites. In this case, we are doing a food distribution for veterans, and while I'm recruiting for my study, they are helping to distribute the food. We also have Trenton Townsend, who is a very insightful qualitative methodologist, just under the IQuest sign. And then the smiling lady at the bottom, that's Ms. Chastity Wolford. She is a VA peer support specialist. She does have a more professional headshot, but I thought this photo really captured her spirit as she is surrounded by a group of women who you do not see in the picture because I had to crop them out, but she's in her element in this picture. And then right next to her is Mr. John Smith. That is his real name, and he is a Marine veteran. He was one of the two veterans, along with Shannon Downey, who was a Navy veteran, who helped me with early conceptualization and research design for this study. Next slide, please. I would like to acknowledge the VA for funding the research that you see here or that I'll present here. And then, of course, we have our standard disclaimer that the views expressed in today's presentation are those of the authors and do not reflect the position or policy of the Department of Veteran Affairs or the United States government. Next slide, please. I'm getting close to presenting, but before I do that, I do want to ask for some request for some grace. This has been a particularly challenging month in July, for reasons that I'm not going to burden you with. And I almost contemplated canceling this cyber seminar. However, I also recognize that as a researcher, it is my job to disseminate the information that we learn through our research. And I felt that this particular month, where I kind of felt like I was in survival mode on some weeks, it was a lesson in the empathy that I needed to build for the veterans that I work with. My ability to think ahead and really prepare for the future was significantly reduced in the past couple of weeks, but I have resources to support me, and I have the ability to be resilient, and I know that these conditions are going to resolve. But it is also a similar state that a lot of the veterans who I interviewed for this study live in on an indefinite basis. So I just wanted to put this out there, and then let's move on with the rest of the presentation. Next slide, please. All right, so this is the one and only poll question that I have in this presentation, but I would like to know what's your relation to veterans. Your options are: I am a veteran, I am a frontline healthcare provider who serves veterans, I'm a researcher focused on veterans, I work with a community organization that serves veterans. I am with a program office that serves veterans, or I am an advocate for veterans, but not in any of the capacities listed above. If you could take a moment, please, and put an answer to that poll.
Thank you, Dr. Kamdar. The poll is open, and I can see that people are making their choices. I think you provided a lot of choices, so we may have to leave it open for a little bit.
Okay.
Audience members, if you don't see the poll, you should see it to the right of the big slide that's being broadcast. I just opened it up, so you should be able to see that polling panel to the right of the slide under participants or Q&A. I did get one complaint that a person isn't seeing the slides. I'm not getting other complaints about that. So I think it must be you. There must be a problem at your end. And I'm sorry, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to help you out with that, but we can talk in the Q&A where you sent your question. Okay, well, it looks like things have slowed down, Dr. Kamdar, so I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share the results out. But I'll read them off to you. 7% answered A, that they are veterans. 32% answered B, frontline healthcare provider. 20% answered C, a researcher focused on veterans. 1% answered D, with a community organization. 12% answered E, with a program that serves veterans. And 5% answered F, I'm an advocate for veterans, but not in any of those capacities listed above.
Oh, well, thank you so much for that, Rob. All right, we're going to move on to the next slide. And thank you for the members who answered the question. Appreciate that. All right, so food insecurity. There is a USDA definition, which is it's a household level of economic and social conditions of limited or uncertain access to adequate food. But I like to use this definition that's provided by the photograph that is next to to the written definition. This photograph was taken by a Navy veteran who was living with food insecurity at the time that he took the photo. And what you'll notice as you look at the photograph is, one, there's just not a lot of food in the refrigerator itself. There's some chicken nuggets, there's some eggs, a good number of condiments. There's no fresh produce, at least none that I could notice. And just overall, it's pretty lacking. Does not look like, hopefully, most of our fridge is at home. And so to me, this image of food insecurity is a lot more powerful than the definition, which kind of separates us from the reality of what people experience. Next slide, please. Food insecurity is a known threat to veteran health and well-being. We know that, well, there's been some studies that show that when we control for socioeconomic factors, veterans have almost a threefold increase in odds for having very low food security compared to civilians. And as a reminder, very low food security means that the person is actually skipping on meals or they're cutting back on what they're eating. When I've asked veterans why this may be, why veterans are more likely than civilians to skip out on meals, they describe that this is behavior that they're trained in, that they're rationing their intake so that they have enough food for their children or their partners. Veterans who are living with very low food security are also almost four times more likely to have thoughts of suicide compared to veterans who are food secure. So this means that it is really important to help veterans who are food insecure. But in order to help veterans who are food insecure, we really need to know first what they are currently experiencing. And that is part of the reason why we did this study. Next slide, please. When we look at how the current programs that are out there to help veterans, the current solutions to food insecurity, they primarily fall under two categories. One are federal assistance programs like SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and the second one are charitable food distributions. And again, these photos came from another study that I did prior to the one that I'm presenting on today, but these two photographs are again taken by veterans. One, The first one on the top is the SNAP card or the EBT card that they use to access their food. And then the bottom one is of a food pantry. So when I was doing that prior study, I was getting some hints that although these programs exist, there are some challenges that the veterans were experiencing getting to those to these current solutions. And I wanted to understand what they actually experience. Like, what do they go through as they go to SNAP or as they go through the food pantries? So that was one of the reasons, the rationale behind the study. Next slide, please. And I've already just mentioned that, again, there was some prior research that indicates that there's some challenges. And the goal here is to understand the veteran perspective. So next slide, please. With that, in order to understand what's going on, I took an approach of looking at this research through human-centered design. So a very oversimplified definition of human-centered design is that I, as a researcher, know how to get things done. I just don't necessarily know what needs to be done. And when we use human-centered design, we are really taking the people who are most impacted by the problem we're trying to address. We put them at the center and we don't just study them. We ask them to be involved in our research. We partner with them to understand what questions we need to ask in order to discover what's happening first. And then we take what we learn from that discovery phase and we move it to the design phase where we take insights. We work with folks who are affected by the problem and those organizations or those systems that are going to be part of the solution development. And in partnership with everybody at the table, we start to construct a solution that would be feasible, acceptable, and viable. And then we take that solution that we've designed and we go and pilot it on a small group of real people to see how it works. This isn't too unlike the research process, but the main component here is that we are integrating those who are most impacted at the beginning and continuing to work with them throughout. Okay. Next slide, please. So in this particular study, I focused on discovery, which is what veterans who are food insecure experience as they seek assistance. This is a critical step because if we don't first discover what's currently happening and we jump right towards designing solutions, we may miss the mark. And that's why we start with discovery and human-centered design. Even though we have assumptions, we have to take those assumptions, put them aside, and almost rediscover what's currently happening. Next slide, please. So in order to do the discovery, the first thing I needed to do was I selected to create a journey map. So a journey map is basically where we're documenting what somebody experiences as they go through each of the steps to achieve a goal or a task. And we're also documenting what emotions they felt while they're doing it, those pain points that they encounter, and we're trying to identify areas that we can improve. To create this journey map, I worked with Shannon and John, and we sat down and first we looked at the literature to see kind of what are those steps that are recommended. The American Academy of Family Physicians and the American Hospital Association have some toolkits that are already out there that talk about the need to screen and then connect veterans to resources or connect individuals who are identified as having food insecurity with resources. So we use that as the basic template. And then I actually tested the journey map template with Shannon and John to see if we could capture their experiences on the map that we had templated out. And we realized that we needed to also include factors like what were those contributing circumstances. And then we needed to focus in on just two of the solutions, the two primary solutions to how veterans can address food insecurity. So we focused in on SNAP and food pantries. And so this was the basic template that we used then to create our interview guide. In addition to the interview that we used following this journey map, we also had veterans complete a short survey to collect data on demographics. They also did an 18-item household food security survey. They did an 8-item patient health questionnaire depression scale, the PHQ-8, and we also had them do the 7-item general anxiety disorder scale, the GAD-7. The next slide, please. So our study was conducted here in Houston, Texas. Houston has a generally greater level of a higher prevalence of food insecurity compared to the rest of the United States population. It also is one of the most diverse cities in the United States, and it also has a relatively large population of veterans, making this a fairly good site to do the study. One of the goals in this study was also to identify veterans who may not already be connected to the VA services. So with that, we recruited veterans through the VH clinic lobbies, but we also went out into the community organizations and we tried to recruit veterans directly from the community. The inclusion criteria for our research was that the veterans needed to be between the ages of 18 to 65, and they had to screen positive to the hunger vital sign. And the way that we screened the veterans was basically, once we identified a veteran who was interested in the study, I basically asked them if they were between the ages of 18 to 65, and then I presented them with verbally asked them the two questions on the hunger vital sign, and if they said yes to either, then that qualified them for the study. The next slide, please. So our study sample ultimately had 30 veterans. We really were aiming to intentionally get a diverse range of veterans, both men and women, and also different veterans, both with children in the household and without children in the household, because these are factors that can influence the dynamics of food insecurity. So the average age of the veterans that participated in our study was 51. We did have a fairly good mix of the genders. We had 53% of the veterans as self-identifying men, 43% were self-identified as women, and we had one transgender woman. 64% of our veteran population were single, and we had 36% of the population that were in a partnered relationship. About a third of our sample had households with children. And in terms of the rurality, we did find 33% of our population to be in rural areas, 60% in urban areas, and 7% were unidentified. In terms of employment, this only 6 out of the 30 veterans that we recruited were employed. And one thing that I do want to draw your attention to is the level of food insecurity within our study population. 78% of the veterans that participated in our study were experiencing very low food security. So, as a reminder, that's the one where they're skipping meals or they're rationing their intake. And the next slide, please. So now we're going to get into the journey map findings. The first part of the journey map was to look at what contributed to the circumstances that made a veteran food insecure in the first place. And we start like here I'm listing the three either most commonly stated conditions or in the interpersonal violence case, a salient one. So as you saw in the previous slide, only a small population of our veterans, only 6 of the 21 or 6 out of the 30 were employed. The rest were either unemployed or underemployed. And almost all of the veterans that were in our study had come from the enlisted rankings. So when they came out of military service, they were usually finding jobs that, like in case of one veteran, she found a job at Subway, and she continued for decades to work in a job where she was basically earning a low salary, even though she worked 40 hours a week. In other cases, veterans did come out, they got trainings, they got certifications, but in some cases, the mental health component that they were dealing with caught up with them, along with changes in with when the pandemic hit, and they became unemployed, and some of them still struggle with unemployment. Poor mental health was also a condition that came up pretty often veterans talked about how when they are struggling with their mental health, they just can't figure out what else they need to do. And consequently, they can spiral into a place where they might find themselves homeless and also food insecure. And it was just hard for them to know what they needed to do and start carrying out that next step. And as I mentioned earlier, the interpersonal violence was something that wasn't really brought up a lot. It was brought up by two veterans specifically, but I thought it was a salient factor that to include here. In one case, the violence was domestic violence, and the veteran was a mother of three children, and basically she was, like we see in a lot of domestic violence cases, staying with her partner because of the source of income. As soon as she left the relationship with her children, she found herself homeless, living in her van, and then going to a shelter. The other person who talked about the interpersonal violence was the transgender woman, and she talked about getting beaten, being raped, and she also talked about discrimination, which I bracket under violence as is a form of violence. She tried very hard to find a job and was basically oftentimes looked over because of her appearance. And so these were some of the factors that contributed to veterans being food insecure in the first place. And in some of these cases, the conditions that led to them being food insecure, they lasted for years. And as we go through the map, you'll see we'll kind of circle back to these contributing causes. The next slide, please. So then in the as we look at the journey map, the next phase in the journey map was starting to look at how were veterans being identified for food insecurity. And here we kind of struggled with the wording. You know, is this recognizing food insecurity, identifying food insecurity? In the original template, it was screening for food insecurity, kind of aligning with what the American Academy of Family Physicians and American Hospital Association list. But we switched it to identifying food insecurity because when we asked our veterans, the 30 veterans in the study, about being screened in the clinics, it could be a VHA clinic or any healthcare clinic, none of them had been screened. None of them could recall being asked about their food needs. Some of them could recall being asked about thoughts of suicide, but you know, I read to them the hunger vital sign question, where I'm like, well, maybe they might have asked you differently, like, do you have enough food to eat, or do you have trouble getting enough food? And they're like, no, nobody's asked us about our food. The closest that we got to being screened in the clinic was really veterans who were involved with social work. So if they were already part of something like HUD-VASH, or if they were already seeing maybe a case manager for mental health, then when they would have those interactions with their social worker or their case managers, they would be asked, how are things going? It was like a more a generalized question. Do you have everything you need? Not a specific, are you having any trouble getting enough food to support your needs? Nothing like that, and nothing like the hunger vital sign. But a couple of things came out that were interesting as we talked about screening and being identified for food insecurity. And one of them was that veterans said, you know, even if somebody asked us if we were having trouble getting enough food to eat, we're not going to answer that question honestly. And when I asked them why, they said that a lot of it depends on trust and how that person is asking them. So if they sensed that the person was asking them because they were trying to check a box, or you know, what they were being asked without a sense, if they felt like they were being asked a question without an honest sense of empathy or care, then they were just going to say no, we're fine. If they, for one veteran who was actually food insecure and homeless, it would have taken him months before he agreed to, before he would admit having a need for some help. The other thing that they offered was that Perhaps they weren't asked if they were food insecure because of how they appeared. They are trained in the military, as one Marine veteran was telling me. They're trained to maintain their appearance. How they present themselves is matters. And they just talked about how on the outside, we don't look like people who struggle. Now, between the audience and myself, I don't really know what somebody's food insecure would look like. But I can tell you, as a researcher doing this research, when I was recruiting veterans for not this study, but the prior one where we were taking the photo elicitation study that I did prior to this one, I did have to teach myself to ask every veteran that was coming into the VSO lobby that I had parked myself in. I had to train myself to ask each one of them if they were food insecure and to approach them for the study recruitment, because I was basing who I was going to approach for the research off of my own biases. For example, what I mean by that is if I saw maybe a middle-aged white male veteran walk in wearing a buttoned-up shirt and khaki pants, I would not have felt comfortable going up to them and saying, "Hey, can I ask you if you'd like to participate in my study? I have a couple of questions." And then one of those questions being the hunger vital sign, I had to actually teach myself to get over that bias and approach everybody that came in, because on the outside, they really don't look like they're struggling. See if there's anything else here. So with that, let's move on to the next phase of the journey map. Next slide, please. So once they're identified as being food insecure, the next phase is finding those resources and connecting. Compared to the civilian population, the number of resources that are available for veterans is greater. Not necessarily more easily accessible, but they're definitely out there, like the HUDVASH program. I mean, sorry, not HUDVASH, that's housing, but veterans struggle to basically connect to the resources. So those that were connected to a social worker or case managers, their pathway to finding those food distributions that were out there was a little bit easier compared to the veterans who were not connected to any sort of social worker case management programs within the VA. However, like a lot of things in healthcare, their access to those different programs or those different distributions really varied and depended on the social worker themselves. So, you know, just like when we go to our healthcare providers, one provider might offer a different level of care and services compared to somebody else. The care that the veterans got wasn't always standardized. And so some of them got the information proactively. They got emails or they got sent the information from the case manager as soon as the case managers got it. Others reportedly got it maybe a day after the food distribution. They still got it, the information, but they got it a little bit late, or they might have gotten it the day of. For those veterans who had to go about the process on their own, finding resources was extremely complicated and time consuming. Two veterans talked about how they sat in front of the computers for several hours a day, and they treated it almost like a secondary job, just trying to find out what resources were out there. A lot of times what they eventually found was through word of mouth from other veterans who that information that they got through other veterans was more trusted. They felt like it was more reliable. But just like the information that the veterans were receiving through their social workers or the case managers, it wasn't standardized either. So it really depended on who you spoke with, when you spoke with. It was almost like serendipitous when they got the information. So the quote that I've got here about feeling like an ant, it was given to me by the veteran who was both homeless and also dealing with food insecurity. He was actually volunteering at a food pantry, and that was his strategy of how he was going to get food. He volunteered at the food pantry That way he could get food without having to necessarily ask for it. He could just, as he was stocking the shelves at the end of the day, they usually would let their volunteers take what they needed. And so that's how he had his access to food. But here he also described like how he felt, and just how he felt small. And the next quote next to that is, when you feel small like that, it's hard to, even if you felt like you could trust someone, it's hard to even ask for certain things. I wanted to share this quote with you guys because, once again, like these veterans, they're not finding the resources that readily or that easily. It's not like they can just hop on the computer and do a Google search and find a list of food pantries, or find the SNAP application and fill it out and, go straight to it. They are spending a lot of time doing this, and it's a challenge. And so when you are already struggling just to get your basic needs met, and then you've got this added burden of having to find your resources on your own, is tricky. So let's go on to the next slide. So eventually, though, all of the veterans, the 30 veterans that we interviewed, they did find the resources. They did find access to SNAP, or sorry, they did find out about SNAP, and they also had a list of food pantries. So we're going to first talk about SNAP. So with SNAP, this is the largest federal assistance program that the U.S. government offers. It is, again, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. All of the veterans who participated in our study had knew about SNAP, and several of them had applied more than once for it. Out of all of the veterans who were in our study, only 11 out of the 30 were actually had actually received SNAP or were still receiving SNAP. And there's a couple of things that they sort of broke down for me, which I want to share with you. And those include the fact that when you are trying to apply for SNAP, you need to have some basic things like internet access. You need to have a computer or a smartphone, and you need to have a stable address and contact information, because once you fill out the SNAP application and you send it, their decision letters come through the US mail. And so we had a couple of veterans who were either couch surfing or they were evicted, and that address that they had used in the prior application was no longer a viable address for them. So they missed out on SNAP because of that. Some of the others, at the end of this presentation, I'll share the article that is published for the study. But one of them went into detail about how she had to first find a ride to get to a site that had a computer and a Wi-Fi and somebody on site to help them fill out the SNAP application. And ultimately, she ran out of time because she got there towards their closing time, and she had to start over again. But just applying for SNAP is tricky for the veterans that were in their study. And for most of them, they didn't qualify. So even if they got their applications in, a couple of them talked about how they didn't qualify or they didn't meet the income criteria because either their VA disability payments or their child support payments were being counted as income, even if they weren't necessarily getting child support payments. So the income qualifier and the access to internet, computers, and stable addresses were barriers to a lot of the veterans getting qualified for SNAP. One of the veterans, the mother of three who was part of the domestic violence situation, she had actually applied for SNAP 3 times. And in one of those application processes, she was in the shelter. And she, as we were talking, doing the interview, she told me that she's been burned so many times that she doesn't even try to bother anymore. Let's go on to the next solution. Next slide, please. So the next solution to addressing food insecurity in the veteran population is food pantries. These are also called maybe food banks or food shelves. They have a couple of different names. And overall, veterans are very thankful that food pantries existed. But there were some challenges in terms of the food meeting both quality, quantity, and their access to the food pantries was a little bit challenging as well. So here, this is a quote from a diabetic actually. And she talked about how she actually got 30 pounds of white potatoes. And she's a type 2 diabetic. So 30 pounds of white potatoes does not comply with the diet that she's supposed to eat. But from the food pantry's perspective, they are receiving their food largely through donations. So they don't necessarily control what they get, and therefore they can't control what they distribute either. So it's sort of like a bit of a catch. But overall, the veterans talked about how food pantries would be a place that they go to when there was no other option. If it was coming down to a family member going hungry, they were going to go. But they did feel like there was a disconnect between the food that they were getting, the quality, quantity. Some even talked about how they would return the food to the food pantry because it wasn't something that they were going to consume when they got home. All right, so if we could go to the next slide, please. So at the end of this journey map, and knowing what they responded to in the USDA House of Food Security survey, where we found that nearly all of the veterans were food insecure, the ultimate question was, did the veterans find the assistance that they needed? And the general consensus was that many of them were still food insecure. As this one veteran said, I'm still in limbo. So let's go on to the next slide. One of the reasons that I use human-centered design is while we're doing the discovery phase and we're trying to understand what the issues are, the challenges that veterans are experiencing, the goal isn't just to highlight the problems, it's actually to come up with solutions. And so we take all of these gaps that we see in the care that they're receiving and we turn them into opportunities to improve, right? So when we start to look at contributing circumstances, the VA is a pretty interesting place because there's a lot of programs that the VA offers that can actually address the contributing circumstances. For example, the Veteran Readiness Employment Program can help with employment. The veterans, if they haven't used up their GI Bill funds yet, the GI Bill can help advance education, which in turn can help veterans get higher paying jobs, especially if you're coming out and through enlistment ranks and you're looking for a position that might pay better. The GI Bill might be one of a good avenue. So increasing awareness of all the different VA programs that are already out there, along with the community programs that are out there. And the more that we all know, the 32% of the healthcare providers that are in this audience, the more you are aware of the different programs that exist for veterans, you can pass that information forward and shorten the amount of time that it's taking some of these veterans to identify those resources that are out there and start connecting with them. The next opportunity to improve care is screening. So we already talked about how identifying veterans for food insecurity, the screening is just, there's a gap in screening in their clinics right now. And I know that there's programs like ACORN that are working actively to address those gaps. But I think it's important for everyone who touches a veteran to be educated on how to properly approach veterans and screen them or ask them if they need help in a manner that will be acceptable to veterans. I don't know yet what that manner might be, but I do think that it needs to be part of our solution development. And it can't just be limited to specific pockets of healthcare providers. It really needs to be more of a global approach. And then, as we move to the next phase of the journey map, which is the finding resources, this one was a little bit more tangible for some of the veterans to give me some suggestions, but they talked about posting information in common places. We know that a lot of this information is available through the internet. But I don't know how many of y'all have like searched the VA website It has a lot of hallways and a lot of pathways, and you have to click on a lot of different things before you find what you may actually need and might help you. So, some of the veterans talked about have a big sign in the lobbies that say need help, go here, or put signage and put information in places where veterans are going to be seeing it. I know in my hospital, I have found some information about like legal assistance in the elevators, and that type of information. If in addition to the legal services, if there is information about maybe a local food distribution coming up, or if there was a service that would help with the SNAP applications, all of that stuff might make finding those resources just a little less challenging for veterans, especially the ones who are not connected to social workers already. And then, I also know that there's efforts right now with food hubs through the Food Security Office. So hopefully, as those go into place, we'll start to see a reduction in these challenges with finding resources as well. When it comes to SNAP, that's a little bit more complicated because, again, it is a federal program that is run through states. But taking a hard look at the eligibility policies for SNAP might be one starting point. Really looking at how much income is needed to have a sustainable life in the United States, and then comparing that, basically asking people to look at the poverty level. And it's 100, and I think SNAP is 125% of the federal poverty level or lower. Is that a viable level, or should we try to boost that a little bit? I know that there's some programs out there like the Shadow Subsidies program that's affiliated with the SSBF, and that's a program is for housing, so it's not related to food, but it does not punish people if they are able to make a higher income. They can still continue to receive housing assistance even as they get job promotions or they find better paying jobs. They don't lose their rental assistance through that type of program. So something similar to that for SNAP might start to help people climb out of these conditions where there are food insecure and we don't have them going through the circular process. The next one would be bringing back client choice in food pantries. I know that prior to the pandemic, there was a hard push, at least through the Houston Food Bank, to allow veterans or and any of the individuals that used their food pantry to choose what they wanted to eat. It was more like a grocery store where you would take a shopping cart and, shop for food, although you're not actually paying for it. But with the pandemic, that pretty much stopped, and it went to drive-through food distributions, or box distributions where you don't really get to choose what goes in the box. There are now some different models coming out where people can go online and select their like create their own boxes. That's one other approach to using choice, but empowering people to choose what they bring home in terms of food has a lot of value. Next slide, please. So this was a study, and it does have some limitations that are worth sharing. Again, the goal was to try to get some veterans who weren't enrolled in VA care because I'm trying to figure out, if veterans who aren't affiliated with VA services already, if they what challenges they face that could be potentially different than veterans who are already in the VA. Unfortunately, even though I recruited out in the community, I did not find anybody who was not yet affiliated with the VA, which I guess is a good thing, but didn't really serve my purposes as a researcher. We also focused on only one geographical region of the United States, which is Houston. And given that programs like SNAP are state run, even though they're federal programs, there might be some variations in experiences for veterans in other states. And then I only focused in on SNAP and food distributions. There are other solutions to addressing food insecurity, like growing your own food or hunting, which I did not dive into in the study. Next slide, please. So, this research again was the first stage of the human-centered design, the discovery phase. And I've taken all of this information and all the insights. And currently, I am working with my, I'm I'm applying these findings forward in my HSR&D career development award. And we're using human-centered design to create some solutions that is currently undergoing pilot testing. So hopefully I can do a future cyber seminar with those results. Next slide, please. The presentation that I just did now, it is published. And so there's the publication for this particular presentation. And then Trenton also wrote up another manuscript that is currently in press on how we did the journey map. And so for more details, you can look at either one of those. Next slide, please. Okay, there is my email address. If anybody here is interested in this type of research or has more thoughts or questions, let's connect. My email address is basically my name, nepa.kamdar@va.gov. And the next slide. All right, so I'm going to stop here and open it up for questions or comments.
Thank you, Dr. Kamdar. We did get a couple of questions in. This one came in around halfway through, so I'm not sure if you addressed it or not, but this person asks, if there's time, could you talk about the process of data analysis? Was the data aligned with the journey map?
I'm not sure if I thoroughly understand the question, but so essentially we did qualitative interviews. So the interviews were audio recorded, and then they were transcribed. And then we used Atlas TI to, Trenton and I created a code book. We tested our code book, and then he coded some of the transcripts and I coded some of the transcripts. And we basically followed a traditional qualitative approach in terms of coding the data. And then as part of our code book, though, we did have the phases of the journey map within our code book. So as we're finding stuff about contributing circumstances, it's getting coded as a contributing circumstance, and then we're subcoding with maybe like the different types of contributing circumstances. Hopefully that answers your question about how we did the data analysis.
I think I saw the person type in, thank you. The next question, this one's a little bit longer. It comes with a little bit of an explanation. Some assistance programs are much more lenient in terms of supplemental income, such as WIC. Excuse me. I do not know if they count disability payments or child support, but they did not count housing payments for active duty last I heard. Do you think adjusting and not counting supplemental sources of income would change SNAP in a way that would allow more veterans to benefit?
I do. So the short answer, and I'll be honest, I have not kept up with the newest changes to SNAP, if there are any, in terms of how the disability payments are, if the disability payments are included as an asset or not. But if they are still included as assets as they were in 2021 when this data was collected, then I think, you know, if we consider the fact that having a disability to begin with is already increasing your cost of living. So somebody who has a disability has a generally higher cost of living compared to somebody who's living without a disability, whether it be because they need additional assistance for their activities of daily living, or they are having more difficulty maintaining steady employment, or they have to pay a caregiver to assist them. They just overall have to, their day-to-day living expenses cost more. When we include disability payments as part of their income that they have to report to SNAP, then that's almost like a double hit. So, you know, if I had a congressperson in front of me right now, I would say, if you're including disability payments as part of the income criteria or the income that's considered in SNAP applications, that should be removed. That would be my opinion.
Thank you. This person writes, HCD is very similar to nursing's meta paradigm. Is this one of the reasons you selected HCD? Is that human-centered design? Yeah. Because of the fit and the agnostic perspective?
I will admit I am not very good with understanding all the different theories, especially the ones like the nursing paradigm. I'm not familiar with that. I went with human-centered design, honestly, because of my experiences when I was a nurse. I went in as a nurse practitioner in the clinic that I was working in. I thought I had all the solutions. I thought I knew exactly what my patients needed, and I was going to solve their problems going in with my own assumptions of what they needed. And I kind of got a smack in the face by one student one time when he explained to me that the hummus that I just taught him how to make looked like the stuff that came out of his baby brother's diaper. That was like my aha moment. Like, you have no idea what these people need. So when I went back to get my PhD, I chose a philosophy of research that involves community-based participatory research. The problem with that is nobody could really tell me how to do community-based participatory research, like give me an instruction manual, for example, on how to do it. So as I was trying to approach research in my postdoc, I stumbled on human-centered design, and I'm like, you know what? This is kind of like telling me a step-by-step approach on how to do CBPR. And so that's why I use human-centered design. If it aligns with nursing, double bonus.
Thank you. This person writes, three questions. Can you please mention the questions for hunger, vital signs, what are food hubs, and example of 125% of poverty level?
Okay. I don't want to answer them inaccurately, so I'm going to say you can Google the first one, but I will say I will try to restate it without Googling it right now because I don't have time, but the first question is basically, in the past 12 months, have you worried about running out of food and didn't have money to buy more? That may not be verbatim. I might have left a word or two out. The second question in the hunger vital sign is, in the past 12 months, have you run out of food and didn't have money to buy more? And again, I'm using memory to recall it. When I read it to veterans, I'm reading it verbatim to try to stick as close to the hunger vital sign as possible. Food Hubs is an initiative that is currently under process with the National VA's Food Security Office. They're rolling those out. If you want more information about the Food Hubs, please email me and I will connect you with folks in the Food Security Office so that they can give you the most accurate information on what the Food Hubs are. But they're, from my understanding, they are kind of like a food pantry, but more than that in the VA. Clinics in the VA hospitals, and they're trying to establish these places where veterans can go to both get food, but then also get connected to services. So that's my simplified definition of what a food hub is. And then the third question was, remind me, Rob. Oh, 125%.
They didn't write it in the form of a question, but they say example of 125% of poverty level.
I would have to Google that because it changes every year. But if you Google, what 2024 or 2023 rather, because it's usually the year before. So if you Google 2023 federal poverty level, it's basically what the federal government defines as what poverty is. It's like the federal government's definition of poverty. And then the different programs like SNAP use that as sort of the line. It can vary state to state in terms of what the line is for SNAP, because those are, again, state delivered programs. But I can't give you a dollar value for 125% because I usually, in my research, I don't use that particular number. I use 200% of the federal poverty level as a marker for what I consider poverty in the United States. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to refer you to Google for the most accurate answer, though.
Thank you. I think this one's from a friend because she says, Nipah, very well done. Are you presenting your work as a VA representative at the White House Summit on Food Security next week? I don't see that they have nursing well represented there. I find that unfortunate, considering we are required to screen for food insecurity In the inpatient and outpatient realms, would love to connect soon.
I would love to connect with you, whoever you wrote that as well. No, I am not. I was invited to the Food Security Summit. That's not the White House Summit, but it's the one that the VA is put the VA National Food Security Office is doing next week. However, I can't go to it because I'm taking my one and only vacation for the year. So,
Thank
I
you.
would like to connect with you.
I think Jennifer Orszag was her name.
Okay. Yeah, well, we've already got a meeting scheduled.
What was the criteria for low, high, or very high food insecurity?
So that's actually defined by the USDA, and it basically is a breakdown of how you answer the 18 questions that they ask in the hunger. So the USDA has a household food security survey module. It can consist of 18 questions. It can also consist of 10 questions if you don't have children in the household. And people, there's a shorter version of it that's only 6 items. And the two hunger vital sign questions are actually the first two questions in the USDA's Household Food Security Survey module, which is considered the gold standard for how you measure food insecurity. I say that in quotes, though. So basically, you take the responses for the USDA Household Food Security Survey and you sum up the number of yeses. And then if it's like, there's a whole breakdown of it. If you, again, look up the USDA Household Food Security Survey module, it tells you how to interpret the results. But it's based off of the score. So it's a quantitative number. And if somebody scores, I think, 10 or higher or 8 or higher, they're low, very low. I don't want to like give you numbers and misrepresent them, but it's a set, the short answer is you tally up the number of yes responses in the USDA Household Food Security Survey module, and then you compare your number of yeses and you see where they fall in the scores. And then there's a score for very low, score for low, score for marginal, and then there's a score for high food security.
Thank you. I just sent out a couple of links that people sent in. I think they're both for defining federal poverty level or 125% thereof.
Thank you.
And then I'm not sure if everybody can see this. I just replied thank you to it, but I will copy it and send it out in the chat. But this person writes, human-centered design is the main methodology we use in the VHA Innovators Network. Anyone interested can check us out here, and there's a link. If you don't see it, you should be able to see it because I replied to it, but if you don't, I'm about to put it into the chat and send that out to everybody right now. Let's see. I think we got one more if I can find it. Yeah. This person writes, why would nurses need to be trained in screening when it's usually a social work issue?
Because nurses touch almost every single veteran that comes through the VA. So if you're looking for who's got the most closest access to veterans and who usually is the primary, like the first point of access, it's the nurses. And just yesterday I was talking to nursing students and they said how like, well, they've got social workers. And I'm like, yes, social workers have a very important job, but this problem is wider spread than we know. And we need to involve all the providers that see patients in the VA, and that includes nurses because they are, again, first point of contact usually. They see almost every veteran that comes through the doors, and they are the largest healthcare workforce in the VA.
Well, I guess that answers that question. We don't have any more questions, and it's almost the top of the hour. So, do you have closing comments you'd like to make?
I appreciate everybody attending this meeting. I know that, or this cyber seminar. I know it's the middle of July, and I know several people were out of town, so hopefully they can catch the recording. And I think this is a very important topic, so I appreciate your office allowing me to present this information. And again, thank you for having a little bit of grace. I know I stumbled at some point, so thank you for sticking with me.
I think a lot of other people think it's very important because you had over 300 attendees, and those are good numbers for our cyber seminars. Attendees,
Great.
when I close the webinar momentarily, a short survey will pop up. Please do take a few moments and provide answers to those questions. Thank you again, Dr. Kamdar.
Thank
Have a good day,
you.
everybody.